explained to Sedlmeyer that it was one of the saddest days of my life that I have to occupy myself at all with my brother's hostilities. In February 1974, Alois died. Despite their rift, Mengele paid tribute to Alois's assistance over the years. "We owe him honest thanks for quite some things," he wrote. In the same letter, Mengele scathingly took Rolf to task for his youthful idealism of the simple life. "You say you have an appreciation for the simple life, which I do know, and you condemn all those Mercedes-Benz drivers and swimming pool owners. You only talk the simple life, but I live it. I hope you are prepared for the consequences of such recommendations. If not, it is only pure jealousy, which I consider human and understandable, but unproductive and the product of a second-rate mind." It was Mengele's second son, Karl Heinz, who continued to be the apple of his eye. It was rare that a letter to Rolf did not mention his cousin's name, and always in the most praiseworthy terms. Directly after Alois's death, Karl Heinz took over the family firm, a job which had rapidly matured him, wrote Mengele. Again, he urged Rolf to draw closer to his cousin. "In your letter, I was looking in vain for a few personal words about him and his visit on your birthday." Mengele constantly harangued Rolf by comparing his failures with Karl Heinz's successes and by taunting him for his lack of academic ambition. Mengele somehow always managed to make Rolf feel he was second best. When Mengele received news that his son's first marriage had broken up after only a year, it was Rolf's decision not to pursue a doctorate that preoccupied Mengele. He was convinced Rolf's laziness was the root of the problem, and he castigated Rolf for letting him down on the only thing I asked of you in my whole life. He further chided Rolf, "I doubt that being an attorney would satisfy me. If I compare it to being a medical doctor or any kind of PhD, then I must draw a negative conclusion." In this same letter, Mengele had only harsh words for Rolf on the failure of his marriage. "When it finally finished, it did not, of course, surprise me. The speed with which you ruined your marriage can only be considered in a favorable light, in that the liquidation of a marriage without children is much less complicated than one with children. But at the same time, one gets the impression of a vicious circle, because one could imagine, at least, that the split was encouraged by the fact that you have no children. The fact that it took longer for me to find out my daughter-in-law's name than the marriage lasted is a long-standing joke in our family. I do personally lose a male partner with Irmi, who connected me indirectly with you. It wasn't so much, but one who has so little suffers any loss." Their relationship worsened when Rolf responded by telling his father that he would be unable to support him financially. Mengele retorted, "I can relieve you of your worries about myself. Let us keep things as they are. In any case, I haven't been a financial burden to you up to now. I am sure, however, you will manage one or two letters a year." Although Rolf had by now qualified as a lawyer, Mengele continued to remind his son that his greatest wish was for him to become a doctor of law. Rolf had just lost his job as a lawyer with a construction company which had gone bankrupt. Mengele advised, "I would like to express, apart from any regret, the suggestion that, when looking for a new engagement, you should look for one with a more pronounced use as a lawyer, considering that you have already thrown yourself into the arms of jurisprudentia. I suppose this would be very appropriate with regard to becoming more proficient on the subject, whereby I am also thinking about doing your doctorate. Between you and me, this doctorate is also a part of the family prestige." Meanwhile, Rolf concentrated on setting the agenda for their meeting. He criticized his father for his racist views. At first, Mengele said he felt compelled to respond to what he called Rolf's didactic explanations about the lack of racial differences among the human species. I had worked out a long exposé on the subject for you. But Mengele changed his mind, because, he said, it seems to me rather silly that I, of all people, should have to enlighten my son about something the Jews have known for 4,000 years. But early in 1974, the plans for the visit were interrupted by a more pressing problem. Relations between Mengele and the Stammers had finally and irretrievably broken down. What flicker of attraction was left between Mengele and Gita Stammer had finally died. Mengele had so intruded into their lives that Gita and her husband Geza were spending more and more time apart. Geza was camping in the Rosario Hotel in Sao Paulo's red light district, vowing not to return until Mengele had gone. The situation, Bossert warned Hans Sedlmeier, is explosive. Gita said, we decided we couldn't stand the situation any longer. I told Peter, it's all over, it's all over. An 11th-hour peacemaking attempt by Sedlmeier, who hurriedly flew in from Gunzburg, failed completely. He arrived with $5,000 for Mengele, that was also enticingly waived before the Stammers. But 3 days of efforts by Sedlmeier were all to no avail. With Wolfgang Gerhardt back in Europe, all avenues had been exhausted. When Bossert realized that the Stammers and Mengele were about to split up, he attempted to place Mengele in a new home with a new protector. His choice was Erich Lissmann, the owner of the textile factory where Wolfgang Gerhardt had worked when he lived in Brazil. Lissmann had emigrated from Germany after the war, had been a good friend of Gerhardt's, but knew Mengele only as Peter. Bossert went to Lissmann and told him of Peter's true identity. For the next 2 weeks, Lissmann literally trembled with fear. He became acutely paranoid, thinking that cars and people were following him around Sao Paulo. One day at 4 a.m., he knocked on the door of the Bossert home and pleaded to be allowed to sleep in the closet of their bedroom, as he was sure he was being followed. Bossert discarded the possibility of placing Mengele with Lissmann, and Lissmann, out of sheer fright, never told anyone of Peter's true identity. Even today, he denies he knew Peter was Mengele. As the Stammer-Mengele relationship fell apart, Rolf offered to intervene, but his father told him not to bother. I acknowledge your good intentions of wanting to help me in this way, but you must realize that it is not possible like that. The information you receive about my situation is not accurate enough for you to make a proper judgment. The facts are these. My alleged attempts to influence are strictly within the limits of what is suitable to my station and necessary for life. My behavior has remained unchanged for all these many years. And I also have identified with the family's lot in every respect. For logical reasons alone, one can be convinced of my tireless efforts to keep the domestic atmosphere as pleasant as possible. It is not always possible. The fault is not just mine. The Stammers decided to make the final break with Mengele by selling their Caieiras farm and moving to Sao Paulo. They did not take Mengele with them. In November 1974, the Stammers sold their house at Caieiras to Laerte de Freitas, a Brazilian millionaire, and bought a large 10,000-square-foot villa on the outskirts of Sao Paulo. They moved to their new home in December, and Mengele stayed at Caieiras until February 1975. He felt the Stammers had deserted him, and he bitterly complained and moped in self-pity. Despite the extent of the problems between them, Mengele, until the final breakup, thought that he and the Stammers had decided to buy one large house and live together once again. But they tailed off on their own. That is their malicious cunning, he wrote in his diary. Again, it is not so much to be alone, but to be left in the lurch that hurts so much. Mengele grew anxious about where he would live. Now it is naturally much more difficult for me to find suitable housing, he wrote in his diary. He did not want to move into his center city apartment because he needed the monthly income from its tenant. He did not ask the Bossetts if he could move in with them because they and their two children lived in a small two-bedroom house that had no room for another boarder. Moreover, it is doubtful the Bossetts would have agreed to let Mengele move in. They had witnessed firsthand the destruction of the Stammer household by the authoritarian and domineering Mengele. They realized that he would use them. Wolfram Bossert said, We weren't his only true and bosom friends. We knew that he had a selfish personality, and he used us as an essential tool. Although there was a certain human bond on his part, there was not real fondness. The Bosserts differed from the fanatically dedicated Gerhard. Wolfram Bossert recalls, We didn't indulge him, Mengele, in all his wishes and moods, because we had our own life. That was the difference between us and Gerhard. Gerhard placed Mengele's fate above that of his family. He would leave his family even if they didn't have anything to eat. He didn't care. He would go away for days to do something for Mengele if he thought that was necessary. We always said, our family comes first, and then comes Mengele. That was the difference, you see. Yet before the end of January 1975, Mengele's housing worries were solved. The Stammers, who had given a Christmas promise to help him, used his $25,000 share of the Kyaris sale proceeds to buy a small bungalow, which they then decided to rent back to him. It was little more than a shack, a yellow stucco bungalow with one gloomy bedroom, an antiquated bathroom, and a tiny kitchen. It was in one of the poorer parts of town, at 5555 Alvarenga Road, in the El Dorado suburb of Sao Paulo, but it was only a few miles from the Bossetts, the only people he could depend upon for regular visits and support. The deed of the house was registered in the name of one of the Stammer's sons, Miki. To the electric company, the new elderly and solitary inhabitant was Peter Stammer. To the legal authorities, he was Wolfgang Gerhard, and to his neighbors and house employees, he became known as Mr. Pedro. For the first time since becoming a fugitive, Josef Mengele was living completely alone. He was now deeply unhappy. His diary entry for April 7th, 1975, shows the depth of his depression. It has a wearing effect on me. To be left so very much isolated and excluded and all alone. Chapter 15. We don't know where Mengele is. On November 9th, 1970, the president of West Germany, Gustav Heinemann, made an important announcement about the hunt for Josef Mengele. It implied defeat for the first time. Dr. Heinemann personally asked President Stroessner of Paraguay for assistance in finding Mengele. When none was forthcoming, his office issued the following statement. We do not know where Mengele is in Paraguay. Before, he lived in the frontier triangle formed by three countries, near the waterfall of Iguazu, and depending on the political situation, he moved between Paraguay, Brazil, and Argentina. He has access to houses of friends in the region filled with many Germans, and he travels easily across the river, Paraná. The region is almost impossible to cross. Paraguay has rejected a previous request for extradition, saying that Mengele had already obtained Paraguayan citizenship. Even assuming Mengele is in Paraguay, it is impossible to attempt any further official measures. To placate the West Germans, Judge Antonio Pérez Domínguez of the first section of the criminal court in Asunción reminded the police that the warrant issued in 1962 for Mengele's arrest was still in force. News of the directive soon leaked out. But, as had happened so many times before, the result was a public relations fiasco. The judge's action was interpreted by the press as an admission by Paraguay that Mengele was within her borders. In reality, it was a cynical exercise in public relations, because the Paraguayans knew that Mengele had long since departed. But Paraguay's ambassador to Bonn, Venceslao Benitez, was apparently caught off guard. Questioned by reporters, he was refreshingly candid. "I don't believe these reports, but it is only my opinion, and I have not received any communication from my government. This is a political conversation that is really only intended to take place between the Paraguayan embassy in Bonn and the German embassy in Asunción." Benitez then made a most revealing statement. Pressed further, he said in exasperation, "Let's talk about Brazil." In hindsight, one wonders if Benitez was trying to signal that his government knew Mengele was in Brazil. But at the time, the ambassador would not elaborate, saying that he knew nothing about Mengele and, "I think it much better for my country to know nothing about him." Into this murky sea of hints, half-truths and speculation jumped the irrepressible Tuvia Friedman, the Nazi hunter from Haifa. His Nazi Crimes Documentation Center offered a $50,000 reward for Mengele's capture, and Friedman urged the West Germans to match it with a $10 million reward. "That would be a dollar for every one of the 10 million killed," said Friedman, adding confidently, "It will help find him. We are not interested in killing him. That would be too good for him." A few days after Friedman's offer, he claimed he had found Mengele. Brandishing a postcard from South America, he claimed it told me where Mengele has been for the past 2 months, and it provides definite and precise information by which to identify him. Friedman's reward offer was the first involving private funds, and it drew extensive coverage in the South American press. Simon Wiesenthal, not to be outdone, then dropped a bombshell. In a television interview with Israel's former Prime Minister, David Ben-Gurion, Wiesenthal claimed he had new information that Dr. Mengele is in Puerto San Vicente in Paraguay. "I hope the authorities in Bonn will act immediately." He said the area was a military zone located in the Alto Paraná region, which civilian police could not enter. The Paraguayans responded that no such place as Puerto San Vicente even existed in the Alto Paraná, and they were right. The Mengele affair had begun to look like a circus. This was Wiesenthal's first major statement on Mengele since November 1968, when he claimed that his agents had snapped pictures of Mengele on the streets of Asunción. That, too, had been a mistake, and, to his credit, Wiesenthal admitted as much 24 hours later. The Israelis did nothing to relieve Wiesenthal's discomfort about this new claim. A government spokesman said that Jerusalem did not have conclusive evidence that Mengele is in Paraguay. In fact, by then, the Israelis had no up-to-date information on Mengele at all. The Mossad was no longer watching Mengele, since his capture had long since ceased to be a priority target under General Meir Amit's administration. That policy was continued by Amit's successor, Tzvi Zamir, who ran the Mossad from 1969 to 1976. "I don't think I spent more than about 10 minutes on Mengele during my term of office," said Zamir. "It was something to do with fingerprints or something like that. Whatever it was, it didn't come to anything." One of the few people who did know Mengele's precise location was tracked down by an Argentine reporter and his Italian colleague in February 1971. They persuaded Mengele's estranged wife, Marta, to briefly answer questions from the balcony of her apartment in Murano in northern Italy. Marta had maintained regular contact with Mengele ever since he went to live with the Stammers in 1961. She had also received letters from him, but, with a convincing act of complete ignorance, Marta breezily lied, "It's been years since I heard anything. I've heard nothing from Herr Doctor. But the stories they print about him, they're just stories. Lies. No, they're just not true. He's a very educated, very gentle, very affectionate man, a wonderful husband, a wonderful father." The following month, Wiesenthal claimed he had just missed catching Mengele on a lightning visit to Spain. Mengele, he said, had been seen driving a car. But by the time Wiesenthal had learned of the trip, it had been too late. Near misses became a familiar cry from Wiesenthal, but the world did not know there was no foundation to his claims. To Wiesenthal, the overriding purpose of his announcements was to keep Mengele in the public eye, something he achieved with great success. By the end of 1971, Mengele's name had attracted such notoriety that it was used by a fellow Nazi, Frederick Schwendt, as a bargaining chip when he was arrested in Peru, suspected of murder. Schwendt was the Third Reich's master conman, a former SS major who tried to persuade Hitler to sink the British economy by dropping counterfeit pound notes all over the world. He fled Europe after helping to run an escape organization working for the American Counterintelligence Corps and ended up in Peru. On December 31st, 1971, one of Peru's wealthiest men, Luis Branquero Rossi, was found shot dead at his palatial home outside Lima. Herbert John, a West German journalist, had once worked for Rossi and was still intrigued by the shadowy world of Nazis in South America. John told the investigating judge, Santos Chichizola, that he suspected Rossi had been murdered by a neo-Nazi group, of which Schwendt was the mastermind. In mid-February, the police arrested Schwendt, who offered details about Mengele's involvement in the case in return for immunity. The Peruvians jumped at the opportunity. Schwendt's lively imagination did not desert him in his hour of need. He spun a whole series of stories about Mengele's business interests in Rossi's empire, and even about Mengele's plot to take it over. At first, the Peruvians fell for the ruse. On March 5, 1972, Judge Chichizola announced that Mengele was a suspect in the case. Rossi's glamorous secretary, Eugenia Cesareo de Smith, and Juan Vilca Carranza, the 19-year-old son of a neighbor's gardener, were already being held as suspects. The press speculated that Mengele had been the mastermind behind the killing, which took place when Rossi and Eugenia Cesareo had gone to his home for an afternoon's lovemaking. On March 6th, the Peruvian police announced that they had incontrovertible evidence that Mengele had visited Peru during 1971. Their inquiries suggested he had been in the country when Rossi was killed, then left shortly afterward. That same day, Judge Chichizola said that Schwendt was cooperating with their investigation into Mengele's alleged involvement. This time, Simon Wiesenthal showed an uncharacteristic degree of caution. He warned that Schwendt was pulling the wool over the Peruvian police's eyes, saying that Mengele was not an appropriate suspect in the Rossi murder in Lima. It is a diversionary tactic. Not long afterward, Judge Chichizola agreed and said so publicly. Schwendt was released, and the gardener's son was convicted of Rossi's murder, though neither a motive nor Schwendt's involvement was ever properly established. Another Nazi hunter in Peru was not so restrained. Flushed with her success at identifying Klaus Altmann as Klaus Barbie, the Butcher of Lyon, Beate Klaasfeldt announced that Mengele was living in a jungle zone 250 miles from Lima. She said that Martin Bormann might be there too. Soon afterward, Mrs. Klaasfeldt issued a second bulletin on Mengele. She said that a knowledgeable German had told her that Bormann, Mengele, and 16 other prominent Nazis lived in South America and had business ties in an organization called Telerana. She added that Bormann himself often lived in Bolivia disguised as a priest, and that she knew of a photograph of Bormann hiding in a fortress with Freddy Schwendt. No trace of an organization dubbed Telerana was ever found, and Bormann's survival of the war remained much in doubt. but Beata Klaasfeld was new to the Nazi hunting business, and this was a salutary lesson in the hazards of relying on the tales spun by informants in the shadowy business of tracking Nazi fugitives. Back in Bonn, the government's hunt had halted, following President Heinemann's hand-wringing admission that no further progress could be made. A catch-22 deadlock had taken hold. As far as Bonn was concerned, the hunt began and ended with Paraguay, which the government continued to believe was Mengele's likeliest hideout. Since the Paraguayans had made it clear that as a citizen Mengele could not be extradited should he be found, Bonn was convinced Mengele was there and he was protected. Therefore, the West Germans made no serious effort to search elsewhere. Although President Stroessner was in a position to provide the information that would have led the West Germans to Brazil, Bonn never played its ultimate card, threatening to withdraw foreign aid. West German conglomerates had too much to lose. Instead, the judiciary became bogged down in an exercise of secondary importance to the hunt. Judge Schneider of the Land Court in Frankfurt, to whom the case had been transferred from Freiburg, ordered a review of the entire prosecution case. An exhausting program was begun, taking depositions before a judge from all the witnesses who provided evidence for the original arrest warrant in 1959. This was important in that it guaranteed that evidence from witnesses who might die before Mengele's capture could still be brought before the court. But, since the hunt had been effectively abandoned, the procedure was almost academic. Called Vorfeschelung, it was the equivalent of a preliminary investigation, aimed not at finding Mengele and arresting him, but at adding evidence to a record which was already abundantly clear. The task of rehashing the old arrest warrant went to Horst von Glasenapp, an investigating judge who had ended the war as a master sergeant in an anti-aircraft battalion in Berlin. Captured by the Russians, von Glasenapp spent May to October 1945 in a Soviet prisoner of war camp in Siberia. Unlike several other members of the German judiciary, von Glasenapp's wartime background did not link him with Nazi atrocities. Von Glasenapp went about his evidence-collecting task with some enthusiasm, not just because he wanted to unravel the horror of Mengele's crimes, but also because he liked to travel. From 1969 to 1975, he became a seasoned globetrotter, interviewing 300 witnesses and making several visits to Israel, Canada, the United States, the Soviet Union, Poland, France, Italy, and Austria. He assembled a formidable document listing 75 witnesses who testified to the monumental scale of Mengele's savagery. Von Glasenapp had no authority to engage in a hunt for Mengele, but on December 9, 1971, he interviewed Hans Sedlmayr, who gave sworn evidence before a court in Ulm. Under paragraph 57 of the Criminal Code, Sedlmayr was warned that he could be prosecuted if he gave false evidence. But loyalty to Mengele and the Gunzburg family caused Sedlmayr to do just that. He told von Glasenapp, "I also do not know what connections there are between the accused and his living brother, Alois, in Gunzburg. I can even state with a certain amount of conviction that Alois Mengele does not know where the accused is residing." The son, Rolf, of the accused, is now a lawyer in Freiburg, and I have known him since his childhood. I know he is very close to his family and frequently comes to Gunzburg. My personal relationship with his son is such that I can categorically state that he would have told me had he had any connection with his father, the accused. Sedlmayr was acting as the clearing center for letters from Mengele to Alois, Rolf, and other members of his family, and he posted back their replies, so the statement was clearly a lie. But Sedlmayr was confident that his dissembling could never be proved. Out came a further stream of lies. "I would like to say the following. The accused was once in the 1950s in Günzburg after his divorce. I had the opportunity to speak to him then. Since then he has not been here, and I can safely assume nowhere in the Federal Republic. Should he have been here, I would definitely have heard about it. He would have spoken to me. I would also like to say that I visited the accused when he was still a resident in Buenos Aires. These were business trips, and I would like to emphasize that my trips were for business reasons. I visited the accused solely for business reasons. If my memory serves me right, the last time I saw the accused was about 10 years ago. I seem to remember it was at the airport in Buenos Aires. I also heard that at about the time that Eichmann was captured, the accused went to live in Paraguay. Since then, all connections between Günzburg and the accused have been severed, and no more correspondence passed. I personally am not in a position to state where the accused is residing nowadays. The accused has in no way been linked to company affairs. Virtually this entire statement was false. Sedlmayr had seen Mengele in Brazil after the Eichmann kidnapping, when he visited the farm at Serra Negra. Mengele and Günzburg were in regular touch, and as their link man, Sedlmayr knew exactly where Mengele was. Von Glasenapp said he knew that Sedlmayr was lying, but claimed he was powerless to act because he could not prove it. We had stretched the system to its limits. There was nothing more to go on with Sedlmayr. Since we could not prove he was lying, we could not raid his house or get warrants to intercept his mail or his telephone. We did as much as we were legally entitled to do. In order to grant a warrant, there has to be reasonable grounds for suspicion. I was suspicious, but I had no grounds. Von Glasenapp had already been told by Fritz Steinacker, Mengele's lawyer in Frankfurt, that he would be wasting his time talking to Sedlmayr and the Mengele family. Steinacker had represented Mengele in his divorce, and he assisted Dr. Hans Latenza in their unsuccessful appeal against the decision by Frankfurt and Munich universities to strip Mengele of all his professional degrees. I knew Steinacker quite well, said von Glasenapp, but there was not much point in pressing him for information because of his confidentiality to his client. He did tell me, however, that he had received his instructions through a Swiss intermediary when he acted for Mengele in relation to his divorce and degrees. I don't imagine he knew where Mengele was for that reason. Von Glasenapp decided not to travel to Günzburg, taking Steinacker's advice that he would find the family and their close friends had lost their memory. He turned to Simon Wiesenthal, whose many claims to have known Mengele's movements von Glasenapp had read. I met Wiesenthal several times, but I never got much out of him. I naturally wanted to know if he really did have anything of value. It was difficult to make that judgment from the various newspaper articles I had read. On one occasion, von Glasenapp arranged to take evidence from Wiesenthal before a judge in Vienna. I put my questions to the judge, and he in turn put them to Wiesenthal. The hearing had been specially convened for Wiesenthal himself. I had told the judge that I was eager to learn the names and addresses of persons who might have accurate information as to Mengele's whereabouts. Wiesenthal was quite angry that I had asked him these questions, and he refused to answer them. He said he was bound by confidentiality to his informants, which I understood. I left, feeling he was eager to convey that he was leading the field on this question, that he was the man out in the front. Perhaps behind his refusal to answer the questions was a feeling that the people he had in mind were not so reliable after all. I myself remained a little skeptical and did not raise the subject with him again. For a man with a healthy degree of skepticism about Wiesenthal's evidence, von Glasenapp's relationship with another Nazi hunter, who made even more extravagant claims, was strange. It raised serious questions about his integrity as a senior member of the West German judiciary. At the end of 1972, Ladislas Farago a best-selling American author and wartime naval intelligence officer, claimed to have pinpointed Mengele's hideout. Farrago was wrong, and his bogus information may have cost the life of an innocent man. The origins of Farrago's relationship with von Glasenapp can be traced to the grueling circulation war in which Britain's popular newspapers engage periodically. Late on the afternoon of November 26, 1972, word spread that the Daily Express was taking delivery of a very large order of newsprint for that night's print run. The Express, which enjoyed an enviable reputation for exclusives, believed it had a major story. It was confident its circulation would rise dramatically. Shortly before midnight, the paper's first edition came out with the claim that reporters had tracked down Hitler's elusive deputy, Martin Bormann, and the news was flashed around the world. The source of the Express's scoop was Ladislas Farrago, who said he had run Bormann to ground in Buenos Aires. Farrago's evidence was a balding man with a passing resemblance to Bormann. He turned out to be a respectable Argentine schoolteacher named Nicholas Siri. In his Bormann article, Farrago also claimed to have spoken to Josef Mengele, who he said was living under the alias Dr. Nardich. Farrago said he had tracked Mengele to the Paraguayan border town of Pedro Juan Caballero. The Paraguayans scornfully invited reporters to the town to see if they could find him. The discovery that the Bormann information was a fabrication provoked a bitter row between Farrago and the Daily Express. The editor, Ian McCall, demanded that Farrago repay a $5,000 advance. "As far as producing Martin Bormann is concerned, you have gone on record, on television and in print, saying that you know where he is, how he is living, and promising to produce him. Perhaps you might consider that the honourable course at this stage would be to repay the advance as you pledged." In the same letter, McCall said that he had learned from his reporters that documents Farrago had supplied to support his Mengele claims were also fakes. "If, as you admit, you have been duped over one set of documents which have turned out to be Spanish translations of old articles extracted from Der Spiegel, it begs a number of supplementary questions. Are the other documents fakes as well? Have we been chasing the body that does not exist?" Farrago was mortified. He said his South American documents on Mengele and Bormann were genuine, but that he had never claimed the Bormann picture was. He accused the Daily Express of jumping the gun. "I would like to remind you that I undertook the writing of the series under duress, in a climate of phony competition conjured up by you. I had no choice but to go along with your demand that the series be written then and there, when you wanted and needed it, especially when I found out that you had already prepared a series of your own, to be bylined by Mr. Stephen, a Daily Express staff writer, alone, although based on my material. I have copies of this article in my possession, and it is a sad and sorry reminder of the lengths to which the Daily Express was willing to go to score this confounded scoop." Despite Farrago's denial that the onus was on him to deliver Bormann on a silver platter, he went on to make some astonishing claims about having met Bormann in a convent high in the windswept Andes. This claim appeared in 1974, amid another spate of publicity for his book, Aftermath, Martin Bormann and the Fourth Reich. "When I was in contact with him in February 1973, he had just moved from Chile to southern Bolivia. A very sick man, he was cared for by four German nursing sisters of the Redemptionist Order in their convent near Tupiza, a remote region of Potosí province in the Andes." Notwithstanding Farrago's extraordinary fabrications about Bormann and Mengele, it is clear from his voluminous files that some of his information was tantalizingly good. Farrago certainly impressed respected historians like Lord Dacre, then Hugh Trevor Roper, Regius Professor of Modern History at Oxford University, even after the Daily Express published the phony Borman story. When Trevor Roper was asked by the New York Times to vouch for Farrago in their attempt to unravel the mystery of whether Borman was dead or alive, the British historian was quite flattering, as he later told Farrago himself. "I told them that you should be taken seriously, and that although I had certain reservations about certain parts of your story, reservations which might well be dispelled when your evidence was produced in full, I considered your researches were valuable, and that you had made an important contribution to the solution of the problem." But after Farrago's book was published, Trevor Roper was not so sure. "My recollection is that when we met in London, you told me that the Borman photograph was not genuine, and that this was before its falsity was publicly declared. I therefore deduced that the responsibility for printing that photograph rested not with you, but with the Daily Express, and that you had disapproved of its publication. Since you were heavily committed to the Express, I can see that it would have been difficult for you, at that time, publicly to disown the photograph which they had printed. However, the problem remains. How did the Express obtain the photograph and accept it as genuine? You do not, in the text that has been sent to me, refer to the matter, but it is a question which the critical reader is bound to ask, and I would be very interested to know your answer to it." Farrago never did provide a satisfactory answer. Overeager though the Express may have been to publish a Borman story, Farrago bore a heavy share of responsibility for its publication. Farrago made substantial payments to all his important sources, and in doing so attracted many unscrupulous informants who presented false documents to support their phony claims. Probably he had become so financially committed to his book publishers, Simon and Schuster, that he had to press on. But in casting his net so wide, Farrago also attracted several civil servants from South America and West Germany who were officially working on the Borman and Mengele cases. One of Farrago's key informants was Judge Horst von Glasenapp, who was investigating both the Mengele and the Borman allegations. They became well acquainted on von Glasenapp's visits to the United States and on Farrago's research trips to West Germany. In January 1973, Farrago paid von Glasenapp $500 in cash and a further $1,000 by check in exchange for information. Von Glasenapp admitted he received the payments, but claimed they were entirely proper because they were by private arrangement. Yet, von Glasenapp was using knowledge gained from his official position for private gain during his term of office. In most other countries, this might be regarded as corruption. Von Glasenapp, however, hoped to make even more money from Farrago. On April 9, 1973, the judge reminded the writer, "I wanted to let you know that I still have one of the largest collections of documents on euthanasia in the Third Reich. Before it disappears into an archive, I thought I'd at least let you know I have it." Von Glasenapp and Farrago had several discussions about prospects for film rights. On August 19th, von Glasenapp again wrote to Farrago, informing him of his schedule for a forthcoming visit to the United States, adding, "I am dying to know what the film people have to say. My situation is such that I could do at this moment with some additional income." It is clear, therefore, that von Glasenapp was depending on Farrago to improve his financial state, and that Farrago needed von Glasenapp for information. Such a relationship between a serving judge and a commercial author peddling inadequately confirmed Nazi stories was unorthodox, but one tragic, inadvertent consequence may have been the death of an innocent man. Following Farrago's claim in the London Daily Express that he had tracked Mengele to Pedro Juan Caballero, Simon Wiesenthal, in May 1973, claimed he too knew Mengele was living there. Then came Tuvia Friedman, who said that his $50,000 reward had also led to information that Mengele might be hiding in the same small border town. On October 17, 1973, the Polish War Crimes Commission said that their inquiries also suggested Mengele was there. On October 25, West German justice officials in Bonn were quoted in the New York Times as saying that Mengele had indeed been located in Pedro Juan Caballero. The same report quoted Judge von Glasenapp as saying that he did not think Mengele would be caught, but that several witnesses he regarded as reliable had told him Mengele was in Paraguay and was willing to talk about his past. One of those reliable witnesses who had spoken to von Glasenapp was Ladislas Farago, who wrote in an early draft of his book, "In actual fact, I was assured by Judge von Glasenapp that my Mengele material proved extremely useful for his own investigation. He told me that the pinpointing of Mengele's place of residence by me, a third party, gave the German authorities an opportunity to raise the issue with President Stroessner of Paraguay during his semi-official visit to Germany in 1973. For one elderly farmer of German descent living near Pedro Juan Caballero, the cumulative effect of this amateur speculation, confirmed as it seemed to be with official statements from the Poles and West Germans, had the most disastrous result. Late in November 1973, a group of men burst into the farmer's home during the middle of the night, beat him, and shot him dead. His wife, who tried to intervene, was beaten and suffered internal injuries. Their three children were left unharmed. According to Adolfino Peralta, the local police chief, the dead man's name was Albert Frederici. He had lived on the outskirts of the town for 19 years and was known as a recluse with eccentric ways. In the wake of the sustained publicity throughout 1973 about Pedro Juan Caballero being Mengele's hiding place, the press speculated that Frederici was the Auschwitz butcher. The man's widow, Enden Tran, described these reports as absurd as she packed her bags to leave for good. She said the murderers had not taken any valuables or goods and that they spoke a language she did not understand. She believed he was killed by a group of Jewish avengers. Delving into Friedrich's past, newspapers claimed that he had been in the German army and had a history of violence and Nazi sympathies. According to a CIA report on the incident, Mrs. Friedrich's suspicion that her husband's killers were Jews may well have been right. He, informant, did say that the former German soldier by the name of Friedrichi had been beaten to death last year by Israeli terrorists who thought he was Mengele. Friedrich's wife lost portions of one of her ears, and her stomach was cut open as a result of her beating. She survived the attempt, and apparently wrote a letter to the German ambassador requesting a pension as a result of her husband being a former soldier. Von Glasenapp said that he could not remember whether he was the source of the New York Times story, stating that West German justice officials believed that Mengele was hiding in Pedro Juan Caballero. Despite the fact that he received money from Farago and was discussing a possible film, von Glasenapp denied that he had been unduly influenced by Farago. "I know that Farago offered a list of rumors," he said, "and I remember saying to him that I was not very satisfied with his material. There were a lot of what I call information brokers in South America at the time." Despite his questionable relationship with Farago, von Glasenapp did make one significant attempt to locate Mengele. When Alois died in February 1974, von Glasenapp authorized telephone intercepts on the Mengele family homes in Günzburg. On the day of the funeral, a grand and stately affair, von Glasenapp ordered the police to mingle with the mourners on the off chance that Mengele might have returned to pay his last respects. "We had the right to control telephones," But there was no success at all. Nothing happened. Nothing. Silence on the Western Front. All quiet on the Western Front. Telephone taps on the Mengele family were never authorized again. Von Glasenapp had played a hunch and lost. Had more hunches like that been pursued, the West Germans might eventually have succeeded. Chapter 16. Pedro, the Neighbor. Alone in his subtropical slum, Josef Mengele rapidly declined. He did what he could to enliven his cheerless bungalow with its cracked hardwood floor and leaking roof. He painted his bedroom dark green and laid a tile path, but nothing could compensate for the loneliness that now tormented him. "My cage becomes more comfortable," he wrote, "but it remains a cage." Mr. Pedro, as he was known to his neighbors, sought out new friends with pathetic eagerness. Two old French women became occasional conversational partners, but he craved intellectual stimulation, and they could not satisfy his particular needs. Even Wolfram Bossert was never quite regarded as a true friend. "It is comradeship," Mengele wrote to Hans Sedlmeier. "He, Bossert, does not seem to have had a friend in his life." With his usual cynicism, Mengele said he was willing to settle for this comradeship because Bossert had helped him in his hour of need. But it was Bossert, said Mengele, who was fated to meet an intellect like him, not the other way around. His financial worries had also worsened. After dining out at an expensive restaurant, he said, "More than one visit a year I cannot afford." Income from his rented apartment left him with $250 a month, not enough, he complained, to sustain his share of regular payments to Wolfgang Gerhardt in Austria for his medical bills. "I have sent him $600 so far this year, which is more than I spend on myself. Not only shall I discontinue my donation, but I'm asking you to do so too," he wrote to Sedlmeier. Mengele suspected that Gerhardt had exaggerated the cost of cancer treatment for his wife and son. In a subsequent letter, he also told Karl Heinz to stop sending any money to Gerhardt until Gerhardt provided proof of the real costs. "He shall report precisely exactly what solutions he has in mind. To begin with, he shall take care of his sick wife. His further disposition will depend on the course of her disease, the end of which seems doubtful to me. The first thing he got out of my plight was to turn it to his advantage and get something out of you. He wasn't satisfied with what I sent him. I do not intend to buy any help from him, but I'm afraid the solution to the dumb man, false identity card, could become expensive." So anxious had Mengele become about his financial state that he was not sure he could afford the record player and tape deck he planned to buy to relieve his boredom. "I am more than ever dependent on your help," he wrote home. Gita Stammer felt that his family could have done more for Mengele. "They were not very generous with him," she said. His health was also deteriorating. His blood pressure was too high, his spinal problem caused him great pain, and he suffered migraines, allergies, and insomnia. A prostate operation was pending. He had rheumatism in his hands, and an area of one leg was permanently swollen, the result of a tropical insect bite in Paraguay. Fear of being kidnapped by the Israelis had also returned, as had his old anxiety about his forehead giving him away. Once he ventured out alone to a sausage shop and thought that a customer scrutinized me too closely. Terrified, he vowed never to go back again. Now living within reach of newspapers, he regularly read the coverage about him. When there was a newspaper article about him, he'd sit and think for hours, said Wolfram Bossert. He wanted to know where the news had come from, and if it was true, or if it was a police plant. At night, he slept with an old Mauser pistol by his bed. He consoled himself with the prospect of a visit from Rolf, though no definite plans had yet been made. In his acutely anxious state, Mengele beseeched his son to leave nothing to chance. "Before I start to look forward to that meeting," he wrote, "I want to know all the details about the planning." Mengele told Rolf, "A visit would be an adventure that would have to be planned very well in advance. A faultless passport in a different name would be a prerequisite. If one has that, then one doesn't need to make any great contortions. The preparatory work for this would be to make precise inquiries about all travel arrangements, visa, registration, etc., and a watertight alibi. If all these requirements are met, then you have to plan this undertaking right down to the last detail and without self-deception. There must be no gap in the plan of operations, and you must be able to have an overview from beginning to end, and it all has to be in your head." In another letter, Mengele told Rolf that the most important feature was the false passport, a dumb man, as he called it. "If you aren't holding a dumb man, we need not waste time thinking about it any more. If you don't know what I mean, have it explained to you by Uncle H. Sedlmeyer. This is an irrevocable demand without which any undertaking means a frivolous challenge with unforeseeable and dangerous consequences." In that same letter, Mengele revealed that his late brother Alois's son, Dieter, now running the family firm with Karl Heinz, had rejected all his attempts at establishing a dialogue. "I do not know Dieter, and I have no information about him," Mengele lamented. "He hasn't answered my sympathy cards on the death of his father and his mother. He wants to avoid any contact with me." Again, Mengele implored Rolf to re-establish ties with the Gunzbergers, whose wealth and power his son mistrusted. And again, much to Rolf's irritation, he praised Karl Heinz. "He has driven his ship these last 2.5 years carefully and with insight and without any regard for himself. He uses his workmen's expertise well and uses the experience of his assistants and has a good relationship with his workers and employees. And he is critical, modest, indefatigable, and he knows what he wants. That's the way it seems to me from here. I do regret that you have left the Gunzberg scene willingly." In his moments of deeper despair, Mengele resorted to splenetic outpourings of fascist rhetoric. He complained how the selection, promotion, and development of over-average intelligence was being misconstrued, misrepresented, and rejected by what he called supposedly democratic principles. He savaged a book by Hitler's armaments minister, Albert Speer, who confessed to having made a pact with the devil before he realized the implications. In Inside the Third Reich, written by Speer while serving his 20-year jail sentence, he described Hitler as a megalomaniac. "To characterize him as the megalomaniacal architect of the nation is a useless attempt and proves the instability of Speer, the expert, to understand the intentions of the order." Mengele went on, "It's a pity that so little of the greatness of the time has stayed in the memory of a man who was allowed to play in the game in such a favored position. Speer hasn't heard, either now or in those days, the call of history. But his attempt to revise history cannot diminish the greatness of that time." In Mengele's view, Speer's admission that he was wrong to follow Hitler was just an exercise in public self-flagellation. If Speer's confessions are real, he has to be accused of severe misuse of the friendship of his Führer, whom he has been trying to compromise. Speer lacked bravery and all the qualities that allow a great personality to be able to make more out of the friendship of his highest commander. He accuses himself, and he takes on guilt, which at times he isn't even accused of, and then he believes, or so he hopes, that this can be atoned by sitting in prison for a few years, now that his head has been pulled out of the noose. Perhaps the nightmare of having to stand in the shadow of the other, Hitler, has always tortured him, and has now turned into revenge. More than ever, In the closing stages of his life, Mengele yearned for contact with his family back home. He asked Sedlmeyer to rent another post office box for the acceleration of post traffic. Mengele counseled Sedlmeyer, "Picking up could be done by you or K.H., Karl Heinz, or anybody else that is trustworthy. In order not to have only my mail in that box, you can send an envelope with a postcard from your occasional journeys to that box. This, of course, other people can do. That way, the receiver stays out of the game except insofar as arranging for the P.O. box, a single effort that doesn't seem unacceptable to me." In this way, Mengele argued, more letters could be exchanged without risk of being discovered. Mengele suggested that renting the postbox in a big town would be safer and draw no attention, whereas in a small village, presumably Gunzburg, it would be a sensation. Mengele's only contact outside his neighborhood was Wolfram Bossert, who brought him recorded cassettes of his favorite classical music. Sometimes he would go for an outing with the Bossert children, Zabina and Andreas, to whom he became a favored uncle, having built a wooden paddle boat for them. His links with the Stammers were now strictly business. Gita and Geza visited only when they brought cash for the apartment rent and money sent from Gunzburg. Mengele was hurt to learn in 1975 that for the first time in 12 years, Geza Stammer had not invited him to his birthday party. His main companion for the first year of his new solitary life was a 16-year-old neighborhood gardener, Luis Rodriguez, who liked watching The Wonderful World of Disney and soap operas on TV. Mengele was so lonely that sometimes he asked him to stay the night. Rodriguez recalled how Mengele loved music and how he sometimes whirled clumsily around the room to a waltz. Rodriguez recalled his early impressions of Mengele. "At first he was very serious with me, and we only spoke about the job, work in the house or gardening. Then, after some time, he became friendlier with me, and he used to treat me very nicely, and he used to talk to me about what I liked, and how I was getting along, and how my family was. He once told me that I would one day be very proud I worked for him, and I would tell my children I had worked in his house." As the year's end approached, at Rodriguez's prompting, Mengele bought a $150 24-inch Telefunken black-and-white television set. He told the boy that he wanted the set to watch the Winter Olympics. He confided to Hans Sedlmeyer he thought it might persuade my new housemate to stay. But Mengele's television did little to relieve the pain of his loneliness. It did not persuade the boy to spend more time. And Mengele reported home that although it was a break in my monotonous life, he got no enjoyment from the set because the channels hardly come through and the repeated interruptions by commercials really do disturb me. Much of the program content, in any case, infuriated Mengele. Television was like a lightning conductor for his moods. It gives him an opportunity to get worked up, to get angry, and to curse, wrote Wolfram Bossert. Deep depression and anxiety had now set in as Mengele bided his time alone in Alvarenga Road, his one attempt at striking up a friendship having been rebuffed. He ended 1975 with a letter to Sedlmeyer noting that nothing can improve my mood. Mengele's spirits and health were sinking fast. He talked about suicide, saying it would be a blessed relief from his aches and pains, and from a world that cared nothing for him. The beginning of the end came sooner than he expected. In May 1976, Mengele spent a Sunday with the Stammer's elder son, Miki, and a friend, Norberto Glaver. When they dropped him off at his bungalow gate, Mengele felt quite dizzy and ill. Inside the house, a sudden pain hit him in the right side of his head. In Mengele's own words, "Fluttering visions, vertigo, tingling sensations in the left half of my face and my left arm, like ants running, and difficulties with my speech and increasing pain in my head were the major symptoms. Later, this barbaric pain in my head was accompanied by nausea. As a doctor, Mengele knew from the symptoms that he had suffered a stroke. I couldn't use either my left arm or my left leg, paralyzing, he wrote. Norberto Glava went to a nearby clinic for advice about Don Pedro and was told to take him immediately to the hospital. Lying awake that night, Mengele spent many anxious hours. I thought, my friends will wonder what to do with that old wreck. Early the next morning, Norberto Glava and his mother arrived to take care of Don Pedro. Then the Bossetts came to take him to the Santa Marta Hospital in the Santo Amaro suburb of Sao Paulo, where doctors diagnosed a mild cerebral hemorrhage. What Mengele did not know then was that his admission to the hospital had brought him within a whisker of having his cover blown. Mengele had been introduced to Norberto Glava and his parents as Don Pedro by Wolfgang Gerhardt earlier in the year. Norberto's father, Ernesto, was an Argentinian industrialist of German descent. The Glavas had moved to Brazil in 1959, where they met the Bossetts because Lizalotta Bossett taught the Glava children. The Bossetts introduced them to Gerhardt. Gerhardt immediately struck Ernesto Glava as unbalanced. He said Gerhardt had a true adoration for Adolf Hitler, made a point of showing himself to be a real Nazi, and wanted the return of the Nazi regime. Both Gerhardt and the Bossetts made a special point of asking the Glavas if they could help take care of their elderly friend, Don Pedro, who was in need of spiritual and social help and friends. Ernesto explained, I thought it was a little strange since I didn't know Gerhardt at all well, but I saw nothing wrong in it either. Once a month I went to the old man and brought him chocolate and helped take care of him. We brought him food and we visited him 8 or 10 times maybe. Just as Gerhardt had not confided Mengele's secret to the Stammers when he first went to live with them, so he kept the Glavas in the dark. He asked the Glavas to take care of the old man because he had to return to Europe to care for his son Adolf, stricken with bone cancer. Gerhardt's wife had died of cancer in 1975. Yet despite this family crisis, Gerhardt had taken the trouble to visit Mengele for a very special reason. At Mengele's expense, Gerhardt flew back to Sao Paulo to renew his Brazilian identity card, which was about to expire so that Mengele could continue to use his false identity. The laminated plastic card was opened up, and Mengele's picture was withdrawn, revealing Gerhardt's own picture underneath. It was then re-laminated in a local shop so that Gerhardt could present it for renewal at the Department of Public and Social Order. After it had been reissued, the plastic covering was reopened, Mengele's photograph placed squarely over Gerhardt's, and then re-laminated. As Mengele himself remarked, the new card, or dumb man, as he called it, was far from perfect. The differences in Gerhardt's age, 14 years younger, and height, 6 inches taller, were glaring. The old Swiss is out of duty, but the new dumb man is naturally not so ideal as it seemed to look at first. Remarkable is the stature, not to mention his age. Nevertheless, I hope it will be of sufficient use for me. It was precisely these anomalies that alerted one already suspicious person to the fact that Don Pedro was hiding a murky past. As young Norberto Glava accompanied Don Pedro to the Santa Marta Hospital on May 17, 1976, he noticed that he was using the identity card of Wolfgang Gerhardt, the unbalanced Nazi who had introduced them earlier that year. He also noticed that Don Pedro paid his admission fee with a crisp $100 bill. Norberto's father, Ernesto, said he had already begun to have doubts about Mengele's real identity because of his conflicting accounts about what he did in the war. At first, Don Pedro told him that he had been a sergeant in the German army. Later, he said that he had served as a doctor at the front. I never knew for sure whether he was Pedro or not, said Ernesto Glava. After 2 weeks in the hospital, Don Pedro was released. Norberto Glava agreed to move in with him at his bungalow in Alvarenga Road while he convalesced. Cooped up together in such a confined space, Don Pedro began to get on the boy's nerves, as his father explained. My son spent 2 weeks with him. While Don Pedro recovered, he had a barbecue and invited several of his friends. But at the end of those 2 weeks, my son had an argument or disagreement with Don Pedro, and he left. He was an egocentric and violent character. We never saw him again. By now, the Glavas had a strong suspicion as to the real identity of this opinionated and self-righteous old man. I found a catalogue from a company for agricultural machinery, said Ernesto Glava. It had the name Mengele on it. I put two and two together. Finally, there was a break-in in which Mengele's Mauser pistol was stolen. To Mengele's embarrassment, the gun, registered in Geza Stammer's name, was stolen while Norberto was there. The discovery of a pistol in Mengele's house confirmed to the Glavas that Don Pedro was not an ordinary senior citizen. But like the Stammers, the Glavas did not act on their suspicions, even though the evidence was now quite strong. My problem was that I wasn't positive, and I was frightened, Ernesto Glava later told the Sao Paulo police when they discovered the relationship in June 1985. He also told the police that they had no further contact with Don Pedro after Norberto Glava left the bungalow in the summer of 1976. That was patently untrue. In his diary, Mengele allotted the Glavas a code name, as he did for all the key conspirators who helped him. He called them the Santiagos, and his diary makes several references to meeting and exchanging gifts with them after the summer of 1976. It was clear that they were not the closest of friends, but neither were they enemies. For example, on January 14, 1977, Mengele wrote to his friend Hans Sedlmeier, I visited the Santiagos shortly before Christmas, and I gave a fruit press to the wife, who took good care of me in those days, a press which she asked for. They brought me a big decorated plate of Christmas cakes. It is going to stay at this level of contact and occasional visits, and it is good this way. The following Christmas, 1977, Mengele told Sedlmeier that he had seen the Santiagos again. Mus, Bossert, and I spent Christmas afternoon at the Santiagos. When the Glavas' relationship with Mengele was disclosed, they tried to put some distance between themselves and Mengele. In June 1985, Ernesto Glava told ABC News, Personally, I never wanted to be an intimate friend of his. I have never avoided having Jewish friends, and I have never been a Nazi. In fact, I have two employees who are Jewish. I consider this idea of neo-Nazism totally passé. I feel very badly about it, the assistant to Mengele, now, because I helped someone who really did not deserve any assistance. But in his act of public contrition, Ernesto Glava made one important omission. He failed to mention that they had received hush money from Mengele. By the summer of 1976, the Glavas knew precisely who Mengele was. The false identity card, the Mengele catalogue, the conflicting war stories. Undoubtedly, they confided their suspicions to their friends the Bossets, who felt they could trust the Glavas with the secret. Despite his anger, Mengele felt obliged to pay the Glavas for their silence, as this letter from Sedlmeier to Mengele revealed. In connection with the Santiago affair, you mentioned that you were disgusted that one had to pay friends for their services. Don't we do the same with the tall man, Wolfgang Gerhardt? If we had considered this necessity with G and G, Gita and Geza Stammer, you might still be together. Mengele's fees to the tall man, which had risen since he acquired his identity card, were proving to be a considerable drain on his private funds. Mariana Huber, the Gerhardt's landlady in Graz, Austria, said that one of the children told her that Gerhardt had sold his ID card for $7,000, in what currency she did not know. To raise the extra cash, Mengele had to sell the Sao Paulo apartment he had bought in the Stammer's name. By selling the apartment, I am getting rid of a lot of difficulties and bother, even though I had to lose some hair, he wrote. Mengele complained in his diary that he did not get much from the sale. Geza Stammer, arrived in order to hand over the accounts for the apartment. That closing of accounts reveals the unimaginable misery with that property, on which I had worked so hard and in such drudgery. Alas, a part of my fate. When I deduct from the incoming $9,000 the expenses of the last 2 years, around $1,500, I get nothing more than just $7,500. Unknown to Mengele, his devoted nephew Karl Heinz had been paying a large share of Gerhardt's medical expenses. News of Karl Heinz's secret funding was revealed to Mengele only after he had his stroke, but Mengele did not like to be reminded of it. I did not appreciate reading in your letter that KH has often been helping and reached deeply into his pocket.